This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four.
Episode 18, 1972, Part 1.
Marvel, on the other hand, was a much smaller operation and much more seat-of-your-pants type of setup. I think when I first started working at Marvel, which would have been late 1969, early 1970, they were publishing about 8 to 9 titles a month. And the office was about maybe the size of this suite. It was very small. There were four people in the bullpen, you know, the Marvel bullpen. John Romita, Herb Trimpe, a couple of artists, colorists, Saul Brodsky, who was the production guy, Roy Thomas, who was the assistant editor, and Stan. And it was a very small operation.
Place to Be Nation, pup! Welcome back to the Marvel Age podcast, our year-by-year journey through the publishing history of the Marvel Universe. We have journeyed all the way up to the wild and wonderful year of 1972. We have a little bit of an eclectic show in store for you today. We're going to be hitting some titles that don't exactly spring to the forefront of your mind when you think the Marvel Universe, but we think it's important to check on those nonetheless. And of course, by we, you will notice I can't do this myself. I am joined, as always, by the rest of the Sarcastic Four, beginning with the manager, Todd Weber. Todd, how are you tonight?
Nicholas Duke, one half of the hard-traveling fanboys. How are you? Thank you for having me back to be one of the Sarcastic Four of whom I have been a part of since the beginning, I suppose. So, no thanks.
I couldn't kick you out if I wanted to. You are indeed the Reed Richards of the group.
Oh, damn it. Ain't I great? So this
actually,
is.
I think with my graying temples, I might be the Reed Richards of the group. I'm not sure.
My mother told me today, you shouldn't stand in the sun. It makes your hair look even whiter than it is. Thanks, Mom. Thanks. Really.
That's you, Mom. That's what you sound like.
So we are here in 1972, which is a very important year for me because it's the year I was born.
Oh, man.
Good God. Speaking
of reached the Todd Weber era of Marvel Age.
Mm. So I'm looking forward to seeing what comics were like when I was.
So when, out of curiosity, what year will be the first year that we will journey through that you read, that you can remember reading?
76, 77, Ghost Rider stuff.
Wow.
We're not that far away. Master of the Kung Fu.
Probably next year sometime. We will be sitting here talking about 1976. Also joining us tonight, the other half of the Southern contingent, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you tonight?
Tis capitalist trick. I am not here. Wait. Yes, I am here. It's not capitalist trick. Nah, darlings. We are going to read about Russia. And terrible Avengers comics, but that's later.
That has become a hallmark of this show. It is the finest tradition on this show, terrible Avengers comics. As we go further and further, I am becoming ever more resolute in my belief that the Avengers were never good until Brian Michael Bendis. And I am waiting to be proven wrong, and thus far, no luck. Rounding out the panel, of course, we could not do this without the man who puts these reading lists together himself, Mr. Tim Capel. Tim, how are you tonight?
Yes, purveyor of all of your hate mail. I don't like being shut out of the Southern contingent, Nick Duke. I don't know why you do this to me.
Virginia gets right. It's right there. It's so far north. I don't know. And I mean, you guys, it's a blue state now. It doesn't really count anymore.
It's a purple state still.
But it's turning blue. You know, we here in deep red Alabama prefer to keep the southern name to ourselves.
I feel like we're never more than 4 to 8 years away from shitting that bed. So, you come to me on what proved to be a great weekend for a Dane Whitman, a.k.a. the Black Knight fan, speaking of Avengers. However, it is because Kit Harington of Game of Thrones has been cast as Dane Whitman in the Eternals movie. So how did I suddenly become like this great big Eternals fan, which will be the film that I am most anticipating now in the next phase of the MCU. But that's not here what we're to talk about. I couldn't let the night escape us on that point.
Absolutely. And you can stick right here to Place to Be Nation Pop to hear all kinds of reaction about that coming up on the next episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Plug, plug. But we will open this discussion of 1972, as we do each and every time, by talking about what we were expecting coming into this year. And so I think it's apropos to start with Tim and kind of talk about, Tim, what you were looking for in building the reading list. As I mentioned earlier, definitely something of an eclectic reading list and one of our larger reading lists to date. Tim put us on a whopping 21 single issues of comics this time out, and it begs the question of why?
Well, I feel like it could hardly be helped because, as you will recall, Marvel has now secured the industry leadership through their kind of diabolical pricing scheme that we talked about in our last episode. So what's really next for them? How are they going to – are they going to uphold their reputation for the risk-taking that we've come to see from this company? Are they going to rest on their laurels? Do they have some other plan up their sleeve to just sort of reassert their dominance over DC? And I was taken by this quote from the wonderful Marvel, The Untold Story by Sean Howe, a great book I would recommend anyone go out and read. Just excellent supplemental reading, some behind the scenes. We've mentioned this before of, you know, beyond what's happening within the pages of the comics themselves, what about the company? And this comes from a marketing objectives plan in 1972 stating, whenever there is a reading need to be satisfied amongst the, quote, now generation readership, Marvel will make every effort to capture such trends and fill such needs. And boy, are they trying to do that here, because in 1972, just taking a cursory glance at our lineup before us, and this is a three-part episode, the first of our three-part series on 1972, we have got just a quantity and variety of names here, just an abundance of new series, new characters, new concepts, suddenly just being flung out into the marketplace. I feel like the likes of this we have not really seen since the early 60s. So they're really trying to flood the marketplace here, flood their newsstand vendors, crowd out DC on rack space, trying to make DC have to take a bath here with their new higher-priced, higher page count comics, which you'll recall Marvel kind of forced their hand in adopting that format. But for Marvel's part, it's just a different strategy. Get all of this content out there, but you've got to fill those pages. And so, suffice to say, what am I looking forward to? I just want to see, through this strategy of throwing everything at the wall, what is going to stick, if any of it. So we'll find out.
Absolutely. Todd, what about you? What were you looking for out of 1972 and out of this list that Tim put together in particular?
I was looking for some new writer blood action excitement. Guys like Englehart and Gerber, and we've already had Jerry Conway, but good Lord, give us somebody besides Roy Thomas succeeding Stan Lee. So we got those guys plus a couple more who I don't recall all their names, but there were some different writing blood, primarily the Englehart and Gerbers of the world. So looking forward to that. And yeah, it's nice to see this little Marvel explosion of new characters and even new tones for books. It's kind of a horror bent, if you will. But we'll talk about
genres.
Genre.
Russell, your thoughts here on what you were looking for out of 1972, and in particular, this list we will be talking about today.
Good God, the Kree-Skrull War is finally over. Beyond that, as Todd was saying, very much looking forward to Steve Englehart coming in, seeing what he's going to bring to the table. But it's the Jerry Conway show for me. Like, that's what I was looking forward to seeing, because I know very well his reputation. I've read a lot of his DC stuff and absolutely love it. So getting a chance to read some of his horror stuff that he brought to the table here, I was very much actually looking forward to diving into some of that. And, you know, there were some surprises along the way. In particular, two books that I had kind of low expectations for wound up being arguably my favorites of what we read here. So there's actually a lot to love on this, at first glance, enormous reading list. Thanks, Tim. But it's when you give us quality, I don't mind the extra long reading list, because it made me want to keep going. So while there is a turd in this punch bowl, the punch is still largely good.
Absolutely. And we mentioned the extra large reading list just real quick off the top. Let me tell you what we're going to be covering today. We will be covering Avengers 95 through 97, Marvel Team Up 1 to 2, Marvel Spotlight 2 to 3, Tomb of Dracula 1 to 2, Daredevil 86 and 87, Marvel Premiere 1 and 2, Fantastic Four 120 through 123, Amazing Adventures 11 through 13, and Shanna the She-Devil number 1. So a chock-full episode in store for you. But Russell just mentioned it. You know, it is the turd in the punch bowl. And as turds and punch bowls often do, they float to the top. So let's go ahead and skim this turd right off the top of this punch bowl and wrap up our discussion of the Kree-Skrull War. This dates back. We've been covering this back in 1971. We read an agonizing, what was it, 6 issues of this story?
Something
and
like that.
Here in 1972, we have an additional 3 that are, of course, absolutely essential to wrap up this story that is just jam-packed with action. Anyone who was listening to Hard Traveling Fanboys back when I actually read modern monthly comics may remember me talking about an event known as Civil War II, and I described it as the least eventful event title I had ever read. And I don't know that this classifies as an event title, because the Kree-Skrull War existed in an era where that maxi series format had not yet been invented. But if this were released today, I think there's no doubt Kree-Skrull War would have been its own standalone title, and it would take over my new role as the least eventful event title I've ever read. The characters are poorly, shallowly written. The dialogue is expository to an insane degree. Neil Adams only does like every other issue, and the issues he doesn't do on art suffer immensely. And the entire thing eventually winds up revolving around the god-awful Rick Jones, who is 100% a worse character than Gambit, and there's no debate necessary on that. This story has a reputation as being an Avengers classic, and if this is an Avengers classic, then once again, the Avengers were never good until Brian Michael Bendis. I hate this story. Oh. It's awful. I'm glad it's over. Someone attempt to defend it. Tim, go ahead.
No, I will not attempt to defend it. I was curious if anyone had attempted to defend it, and I believe you told me off air that no one had rushed to the defense of this story thus far. So I will continue to put out that challenge. You know, jump in there, and if this is a personal favorite, if we're just really missing something, because I don't get it. What's presented here, Nick, as you said, it's just, you read it and you're just like, I understand what's happening, but the emotional investment is not there. The stakes are not there. The stakes do not emerge until the actual penultimate issue of this 9 issue, which included one double-sized issue, we should stress, because it was extra insufferable. And it's sort of like, clearly, Roy Thomas was making this up as he went along. And that's something you do see in serialized fiction, particularly superhero comics, from time to time. As a general rule, I think that's bad policy, but some writers can pull it off. And if you're clever enough in tying together those episodic strands and sort of making it all work out in the wash, you can sort of get away with it. But Roy Thomas has certainly not accomplished that here. This was not an epic. It was just long, and it was way less than the sum of its parts. It just felt like the type of thing you would do when you were a kid, like playing with action figures or just, you know, playing on the playground, whatever, with your friends, and just day by day, hey, what about this? Hey, what about this? What if we do this? Just, it just goes in so many different directions that have no point to them and doesn't really get tied back to, I don't know, any kind of catharsis or broader theme. It's just kind of there existing. And maybe there's a version of this that works. I think that subsequent Avenger stories will kind of borrow sparingly elements from this. But as a plot in and of itself, I think it's a real failure, and it was a real chore to read. Even the Neil Adams issues, I kind of question how much of the actual interiors he handled, because they look a little bit janky. Like, they'll open with a pretty cool, very Neil Adams-y splash page, close with the same, but in the middle, it's just sort of, maybe he wasn't feeling it, maybe he was leaning on his inkers a little bit more, I don't know.
He had assist from John Buscema.
Yeah, that would make sense. So, yeah, I don't really want to spend a lot of time on this here, because it makes me feel bad to talk about. It really does.
It made us feel bad to read it.
All right, so, absolutely. Todd, I'm interested to get your thoughts, because you are often the bronze / silver age champion here on this show. I have a good feeling you probably didn't enjoy this either, but perhaps you could at least explain why people might like this, or why it enjoys the reputation that it does.
I'm sensing no.
That exacerbation says it all, Todd.
I think Tim hit it on the nail on the head when he said it's Roy Thomas making it up as he goes along. Look, the Kree and the Skrulls have been fighting for millennia, right? Yeah, and yet, right, these 9 issues or whatever the hell they are feel like they are far longer reads than an actual millennia. They're all over the place tonally, plot-wise. The covers don't always match up with what's going on in the interior. It just feels like Roy Thomas said, I've got something I can get a couple years of story out of. But it's not enjoyable in the least. There is some good art, I would say. I feel like, Tim, you're being overly harsh on Neil Adams, because I am
compared to
a Neil Adams defender. Well, yeah, but Roy Thomas and Neil Adams have done good comics together before in the X-Men. But this, the art, I guess there are a couple pages, particularly when it's just a Rick Jones versus Ronan the Accuser kind of thing, that, yeah, I guess it's not very good at all. There's a weird sequence in the final issue where Rick Jones is trapped in the negative zone, as are we currently, because we're talking about this story, where he is able to project the Golden Age team, the Invaders, into the foray, which is the first time I've seen Roy Thomas with another one of his cliches, besides Rutland and that kind of crap, trying to be overly hip or cool, or a Stan Lee clone. He is a unabashed lover of World War II comics and heroes, so he gets to bring in and flesh out these pre-existing early Marvel heroes, and that was at least interesting for me to, oh, here's some guys that you wouldn't expect, but they're just from his imagination. It makes no sense whatsoever, and then they're gone. You know, it's kind of like that imaginary Valkyrie thing that happened. And then, oh, look, now there's a real Valkyrie who is somewhat not related to this real one or this fake one that we saw. You know, it's Roy Thomas is just spinning, not spinning wheels, but being exposed here to us as not a very good writer. And I'm sure he's a nice guy. You know, he's kind of like the heir apparent to Stan from Stan, you know, because he worked with Stan. But Jerry Conway, when we AB them, Jerry's got the ideas and the good stuff. I don't understand why Kree Skull War entertains the reputation that it does, other than, well, it's a long-term story. Hey, they kept it going for a long time. Let's give it up to them. Nobody I know had even read this story to me. I don't believe. People may have like the omnibus or the trade, and they look at the pretty Neil Adams art in every other issue. But it's not even all, just all right to me. This book makes no sense. It's really, really strange. And once you really try to break down that last issue, it all falls apart badly. Not that it was going anywhere well, but then you go into this is the wrestle crap material with Rick Jones getting these superpowers, and then the real H. Warren Craddock, who we'd never even heard of.
Oh, God.
The fake one, all that stuff. Ah, we've got to tie this up in two pages.
Why? Yeah.
And moving on. I'm deeply disappointed, as are all you, about this. But stop asking me to defend things that I never said I liked anyway.
Well, from the Russell crap of it all to the Russell crap of it all. Russell, tell us about this story.
To paraphrase one Dr. Ian Malcolm, there is, of course, eventually a war in your Kree-Skrull war. Yes? Hello? Maybe? Nothing. Nothing. There is no war in the Kree-Skrull War. How it got
there? There are barely Krees or Skrulls.
Yes, I mean, there aren't even Krees or Skrulls, really. You know who is in this book, though? Rick Jones. Everybody loves Rick. Nobody came here for that. But there he is. And Roy Thomas, as has been dutifully pointed out, is very in love with his own ideas, especially one that involves Rick Jones and Captain Marvel being formed together into a single entity. Because if you'll remember back at the beginning of the story, they did away with that. Mm-hmm. We've been cursed with that for a long time, and it was like, oh, man, I had this sense of relief. Even though the story was bad, I was like, oh, good. Here's an opportunity to make Captain Marvel not suck anymore. He's not going to be tied to this albatross that is Rick Jones. Oh, no, wait. No. Nope, can't have that. Got to put them back together again. No wonder they killed him in 1982. This is just awful. Everything about this. And it's not the kind of, like, hilariously bad that you can enjoy reading because it's so stupid. No, it's boring bad. Yes. It is mind-numbingly boring bad.
Loaded with dialogue and expository like boxes and stuff. It takes forever to read.
Yeah. It does. And this was only three issues of it, and I swear it felt longer than the already six issues of this that we already had to go through. Holy shit, this is one of the most miserable drosses I have ever attempted. And I mean, yeah, it's the same level of bad we've come to expect from Avengers up to now, but I was so sure this story would turn it around, but three more issues of Rick Jones bullshit later. Nope, it's the same. It's exactly what it was at the beginning. It changes absolutely nothing. It puts all the pieces right back where they were at the end, as they were at the beginning. When you get to the end, if you've read this just for the hell of it and not for, you know, say a long form podcast, you might find yourself wondering, why did I do this? Why? What was the point of it all? I wish I had an answer for you, but I don't. That's the end of my little diatribe. This sucked.
No, it feels like it's going issue to issue. Like Roy Thomas is literally saying, I'm going to write this one this week, and then I'll come back and write the next one in a month. There's no long-term flow.
It feels Star Wars-y in that regard, that it kind of feels like it just got
There was actual wars in Star Wars.
Yes. What I mean by that is it got retroactively dubbed the Kree-Skrull War after the fact with no real, sense of forethought put into it. Like, they didn't really set out to tell this long-form story. They just kind of said, here, now this is this long-form story, and I guess we can technically track it back to the Rick Jones-Captain Marvel separation.
Right. Well, it's as it's going on, he realizes, I guess I've got this arc happening, so I'm going to dub it this.
Yeah.
And lest we forget, issue 95 remarked on the fact that we have little in the way of Kree or Skrulls, but we do have Inhumans.
Yes, that was my name.
Inhumans and Rick Jones.
Yes.
You're fighting an uphill battle to begin with.
It was a personal attack on us.
It was just full assault on the senses.
It was. Yeah.
And apparently this is kind of like an indirect sequel to a little Inhuman story in Amazing Adventures that comes after the story we're going to talk about in a few. But, boy, this particular Inhuman story is so bad. It's so bad. Black Bolt, my God. It's so bad.
This might be the biggest waste of Neil Adams' art ever.
It's up there. It's up there for
sure. You know what? He'd been drawing that Amazing Adventures Inhumans feature. And on the one hand, it's Neil Adams. On the other hand, there's a reason we had avoided it up to this point. I was not appreciative of it just finding its way into this title to, I guess, get resolved. But it's also got this weird retcon about how the Kree apparently were involved in the creation of the Inhumans. And it's, who asked this, you know?
At least the androids were there, and they're interesting.
Well, yes. I was going to say, if there's one positive I can draw from any of this, I think the character work with Vision is okay.
That has been the one positive of the book for a little while now, is Vision seems to be the one character who has something of a distinctive voice. I don't know if that's because he's intentionally writing him as being apart from humanity, but all the other characters talk and sound the same except for Vision, and I think that's what's probably helping him to this point.
Well, you said a lot there, mister.
Rick Jones has his own cadence too, but he sucks.
Here's what I don't get about Rick Jones. Okay, so they introduce him in Incredible Hulk back in, 62? And at that point, while I don't agree with the thought process that went on, I can somewhat understand that other people were doing it of, you need a point of view character for the kids. But kids who were 10 in 1962 at this point are young men now. They have moved on into early adulthood. And so who is this character now written for?
Roy Thomas.
That's what I'm saying, is it comes off like the only people who would care about this character are the people writing it. And I still don't see the hook. It's the same thing with Snapper Carr over in DC, which, we've had a little online discussion about, and Todd and Russell covered on their most recent episode of DC for you.
I
wasn't alive in the 1970s. Did kids actually talk like this and act like this? Because if they did, dear God, I can understand the draft.
I hear you talking, Avenger. it's the dialogue just kills me. And you're right. Every one of these characters speaks exactly the same. They all say the same mannerisms over and over again. And you're like, if this is how people talk to each other, it's a wonder there aren't more actual fights between all of you. Because it's just so, so stupid. I can't imagine anybody actually speaking like that. But then again, I guess 40s gangsters also had their own way of speaking. Maybe there was something to that, and that sounds silly, but at least it's silly entertaining. This is just silly stupid.
I believe we've endeavored on this terrible topic long enough. So let's move on to the next item on our, again, rather long reading list. That, of course, is the debut a little book called Marvel Team Up, which I believe would see Spider-Man teaming up with various characters in the Marvel Universe through over its first many issues. And we kick off here with a couple of team-ups between Spider-Man and the Human Torch. And we are not yet done with Roy Thomas, as Roy Thomas is here to script these stories, both involving the Sandman, the first of which isn't terrible, in my opinion, because it's kind of telling this little Christmas-themed story, trying to, you know, to showcase the idea that villains have humanity and have loved ones as well and can be sympathetic and, you know, somewhat understandable from time to time. The second one then brings in the Frightful Four, and that's a whole other issue, safe to say.
Appreciate that pun.
This wasn't terrible, but I suppose perhaps my relative me going relatively easy on it could be the fact that I read it immediately after reading that Avengers story, and virtually anything would have been welcome after the conclusion of Pre-Skrull War. So yep. I kind of came down somewhere in the middle on it. It's Spider-Man. It's not great Spider-Man, but, you know, mediocre Spider-Man in this era is still kind of at least palatable somewhat. Russell, what about you? What'd you think?
Really liked the first issue a lot because I'm kind of a sucker for those, like, Christmas issues. It really reminded me a lot of a story that happened in one of the Justice League animated series episodes when the Flash teams up with the Ultra Humanite to help some orphaned kids have a great Christmas. It had a little bit of that going on with it. I appreciated the multi-layered dimension of Sandman and the team up between Spider-Man and a somewhat bah humbug version of Human Torch really worked for me. I thought that their dynamic back and forth was good. Art was solid. It's just it's a nice, cheerful slice of life one-off issue. Issue two, on the other hand, is a completely boring, forgettable slog that I had no time for because the way Spider-Man is written in that issue just pissed me off.
Which is somewhat interesting because Roy Thomas writes issue one, but Jerry Conway comes on to write issue two.
I know, and that's really what irked me was that Jerry Conway is the guy who takes over on issue two, so I was expecting it to be even better, and it was not. I liked issue one way more. That's not to say that Jerry Conway is not going to come on and have some good Spider-Man stuff later or that the other stuff he does in this reading list is in any way bad. It's not. It's just this one issue didn't work for me. I thought it was not his best work. Maybe his concentration was elsewhere, but the guy was doing a lot of work, as it turns out, in 1972. So I could see this maybe not being where all of his concentration was. That said, issue two was maybe not overall not awful, but it's very forgettable to me. It doesn't grab me in the fun way that issue one did. So I was not all that enthusiastic about continuing on with that, but, you know, maybe he gets better on it. I don't know if he continues to write any more in Marvel Team Up, but that issue didn't turn my gears.
Gotcha. Tim, tell us a little bit about your thoughts here on these first two issues of Marvel Team Up.
I would give the slight edge to issue one as well, Roy Thomas and all. Maybe it's just with his more limited or narrow scope, he can kind of keep things together. This is also pretty much a self-contained story, mm-hmm. even though the conflict of the Sandman continues to loom large and will be explored in issue two. It's not like you have to read issue two to get a complete story. Like Russell, I am a Christmas comics stan unapologetically, and whether they are historically significant or even particularly good, I always think personally to me they are worth reading, so I was kind of glad to get one on our reading list. This one does have historical significance, of course, with it being Spider-Man's first regular spinoff series, so how about that? A good 10 years into the character's run, we get his first spinoff in Marvel Team-Up. Every issue of this series will be Spider-Man teaming up with someone. First pair of issues here, Human Torch. And, yeah, I mean, I kind of dug this first one. There was some fun patter between Spider-Man and the Torch, where the Torch is kind of maudlin, depressed. We've seen him like this in various issues of FF, where he's sort of brooding over Crystal. But Spidey is over it pretty much from the get-go, and it just makes for some fun interplay there. And just the Christmassy tone of it all, I don't know what to call it, with, you know, they want to do Sandman a solid so he can see his mom, and then he sort of double-crosses him. I like that. Issue 2, yes, we do have Welcome Aboard, Jerry Conway. Good stuff. Art, again, by Ross Andrew. I should have mentioned, not the first time we've seen Ross Andrew. Of course, he did the first issue. He also did an issue, that Defender story we read in our last episode in, what was it, Marvel Premiere, Marvel Spotlight, whatever it was, Marvel Feature, maybe. So many anthologies at this time.
Feature sounds right. Yeah,
Feature. Feature sounds right. Ross Andrew, his art has this sort of, I don't know what to call it, like a almost a whimsical quality to it here. It's actually, the word that comes to mind is quirky. This is something you don't see in a lot of mainstream Marvel superhero comics of the period. It suits the tone of these stories pretty well. It's just, I don't know. It's something rather different from what we've become accustomed to with that Marvel House style. As for Conway, his script, yeah, his Spidey is a little, I don't know, maybe he doesn't have the voice down just yet, but I don't know. There's a weird, almost biting cynicism to his script here and the story that he's telling. Like, in that opening pages, you've got like this sort of tropey character, this magical soothsaying old codger, but he's sort of a bit of an idiot, and he's like gonna swear off booze, and then he sees the Human Torch take flight, and he's like, never mind, I'm gonna take that up tomorrow, and heads to the next bar. Just, you know, that's not something you expect to see in a Bronze Age superhero comics. So you've got Jerry Conway doing his thing. He's all of 19 years old at this point. Writing just this suite of comics that he is at this point. We're going to see quite a bit more of him this year and throughout the next couple of years. It's unbelievable. I mean,
could you imagine a 19-year-old writing comics today?
At
the Marvel or DC level?
Yeah, I think his name is J.J. Abrams Jr.
Oh, yeah. Right? Oh, we're not going to harp on that.
Needs to be seen, I guess. But I'm reserving further commentary on Jerry Conway until later in this
episode.
That's
kind of where I am as well. Todd, your thoughts here on Marvel Team-Up 1 and 2?
Well, so we have Marvel Team-Up. Like Tim said, it's a spinoff book featuring Spider-Man. And in fact, every dozen issues or so, actually about every six or seven issues or so after the first 10 or 12, Human Torch gets to be the feature character in Marvel Team-Up, where he gets team-ups with the Hulk and guys like that. But that notwithstanding, this first couple issues takes everything you like about Spider-Man. Why do we like Spider-Man so much? Part of it is the supporting cast, all the other things going on. This takes him out of that and just lets him do superhero stuff. And it's fun, and I enjoy it, but it's kind of more superficial of a read to me. So this MTU is also one of the books I call, as a young child, I recall reading. I do have a memory of reading some of the issues from 76, 77, Chris Claremont. There we go. His tenure on the book that we'll get to eventually. But these first two, the Christmas stories, definitely better than the Paste Pot Pete and the rest of the Frightful Four story. But it's still okay comics and very entertaining, but it takes away some of the stuff that you really feel in a Spider-Man story. It's just the superheroics to me. And it's nice that you get these done-in-one stories and you get to be exposed to new characters throughout the Marvel Universe. But I think it makes, as an adult reader, I think I want more. I want that Amazing Spider-Man depth and dimension. So these are okay. Very important commercially for Spider-Man to get his second book and help Marvel out and get that character really going. You know, he at this time was also starring on a TV show called The Electric Company. There was a live action feature of Spider-Man, and they started putting out a kids version of Spider-Man in the comics called Spidey Super Stories. There it is.
Oh, right. Yes. So
that may have been some young people in the 70s first Spider-Man comic, and they were definitely written for kids and featuring Spider-Man battling with punctuation villains and things like that. But,
well, in Thanos, with the Thanos
copter. With the Thanos copter. Well, there's a famous, yeah, famous cliche from that. So,
and Dr. Doom riding a dinosaur.
You had to be there, I suppose.
Are those issues on Unlimited?
No, they're not. I don't think they have the branding for the Electric Company. They're out there in your dollar bins. There's no collectability.
I can't imagine they're expensive, right?
No. But they are something. I mean, it's interesting to see the company put out comics featuring their main guy, but not dumbed down. Simplified and reduced for younger audiences. Anyway, Marvel Team Up, very excited to see where it goes because that's a comic I really have fond memories of. I was in junior high when this book ran its course, and you had issue 150 with a fantastic Barry Windsor Smith cover featuring Spider-Man and the New Mutants. No, I'm sorry, and the X-Men. Mm-hmm. But we'll get there someday.
Interesting assortment of X-Men, yes.
Yes, yes. But again, we'll get to that. But that cover, oh man, I can still recall. 1 and 2 here featuring Spider-Man and Torch. I do love Johnny Storm's civilian clothing. My goodness. Fashion plate, Johnny Storm. Yeah, hey, cool. We've got MTU from here on out until it stops, and we're going to be exposed to some new characters in the future. So there's that. But these were okay, kind of middle of the road for me.
Awesome. Moving on to, we mentioned earlier in the show a couple of things. One, that Marvel would be taking a dip into the horror genre in 1972, and also Tim alluded to a little bit earlier, him wanting to kind of withhold comment on the writing abilities of 19-year-old Jerry Conway, and I think this is probably where he was leading with that, as we're going to talk about a couple of different titles. The first up is Marvel Spotlight numbers 2 and 3. This is a two different stories featuring the debut of Werewolf by Night, a.k.a. I believe it's Jack Russell, is that correct?
Yep.
And I got to be honest, this book and another one we'll talk about in just a minute were books that I had zero expectations for. We're kind of expecting them to be cheesy and just kind of eye-rolling and something I could just kind of breeze through and not really leave any impact on me. And I was stunned by how much I wound up caring about these characters, both Werewolf One Night and another one we'll talk about here in a minute. But Jerry Conway does an excellent job of writing this. And then also, I'm trying to remember who was on art here, and it's not
Klug
popping up.
What's Mike Klug did the werewolf stuff, Klug. Yes.
Mike and I really liked it. I thought, right, you know, art-wise, writing-wise, this was really, really well done and wound up making me – probably my biggest surprise of this episode were these two Werewolf by Night issues. Believable plot. It's sympathetic. I dug it, man. I don't really know how else to put it. Todd, tell me about your thoughts here.
Like you, I had low expectations. I've never been a werewolf fan. Have never really thought much of this character, nor John Jameson, the man-wolf, who we're not really talking about at all, but he's a wolf. But Jack Russell, the werewolf
what
by
a thing
night,
to say.
It's an interesting concept, the way they present it, and definitely a different tone for a Marvel comic, and I love the journal writing narrative. Yeah. I loved that, kind of like the I Was a Teenage Werewolf
This is tremendous stuff. I had zero expectation, and it was the best single issue I read this time, I believe. I won't say it was the best story arc, but this go-round, I was kind of floored by this. Great synthesis of, synergy of story and art, and it doesn't really interconnect with any other Marvel Universe characters at this point or locations that I could see in the first issue. The second issue, yes, we'll talk about that. Knocked off my feet here a little bit. I read every page of this, every panel of this, and liked it quite a bit. And I'm surprised that I did, but I'm glad I did. Glad I read this.
Awesome. Any thoughts on the second issue?
The Darkhold. Hey. The Darkhold is a MacGuffin, if you will, is introduced. And so that's important. And you've got some interesting imagery with the kindly, not so kindly couple that finds him and takes him in. But you got this nice story arc with he and the stepfather and the sins of the father kind of thing going on. And it leaves you invested and makes you really care about this guy, Jack. And I'm going to try and hopefully read more of this when he goes into his own series next year, I believe, or next time.
I believe it's on our reading list. Russell, your thoughts here on Werewolf by Night in the pages of Marvel Spotlight.
Is it funny to anybody else that his name is Jack Russell and he turns into a dog?
Yeah, I was waiting for somebody to reach for the low-hanging fruit, and there it is.
I'm glad somebody left that for me. That was nice. Maybe it's only funny to me. I don't know. Solid storytelling, and pretty interesting as it goes along, although I felt like it was getting away from itself a little bit in issue 3. Like it's going for the far, far-out fantastic stuff just a little too quickly. But it does not lose the character work, and has already been called out. That's really what makes this book intriguing, especially it's issue 2. It's not issue 1 of the series, but it's actually really, really great stuff in that first issue. I was right there with you. Had no expectations whatsoever. And as I dug into it, I was like, this is an example of the Jerry Conway that I know from his DC work. This is him, like, kind of firing on all cylinders, getting to do things his own way, and it really does feel like that. It really feels like they said, "Here, kid, do something with this," and he said, "All right, I got all sorts of ideas I can toss into this one," and it kind of makes it his own. The Michael Flug art is pretty jaw-droppingly good. I was really not expecting that, but yeah, this is some good stuff. This has a lot of potential to become like one of those new favorite titles, at least as far as, like, you know, the stuff we've read up to this point. Breath of fresh air is how I would describe it, and it came along right at the right time to kind of really cleanse us of the stench that was the Kree-Skrull War. So, really good start here for Werewolf by Night, and I feel like this is that kind of story that helps Jerry Conway really stand out and make a name for himself. And not to steal a joke that was just brought up, but Jack Russell Terrier, I guess is how we would pronounce that. Terrier. That's good stuff. Anyway, the third issue, though, when the MacGuffin is introduced and all the stuff, the backstory about Jack's dad, some of that wasn't exactly landing with me. I found that the old, like, witch couple was maybe a few too many supernatural elements suddenly being thrown into this just yet, as we're still just getting to know this character of Jack. So I was hoping just to kind of focus in on the werewolf stuff a little bit more. I can be pretty critical of werewolf stories because there are so few good ones out there. But this still seems to be a top tier one for me. I think this has a lot of potential just in the character as is. So hopefully we'll see that explored when he goes into his solo title.
Awesome. Tim, your thoughts here.
Yeah. Yeah, this is sort of a Teen Wolf 1972 in a way.
But no basketball, damn it.
No basketball. I guess I'm grateful for that. But he's kind of a werewolf stricken with affluenza, where and I say that in jest, but I kind of appreciated this change in setting where, you know, so much of the mainstream Marvel universe that we think about is set in or around New York City, right, for better or worse. And here, we are now all the way out on the West Coast, around Malibu, apparently. And I don't know. I thought that that change in setting almost became a character onto itself in a lot of ways, especially in issue two, which confusingly issue two is the first appearance of Jack Russell, Werewolf by Night, here in this series, Marvel Spotlight, one of many interchangeable anthology titles launched in this year, which we will be talking more about. But I would say overall, I'm not quite as high on it as Russell and Todd, but still liked it a great deal, given my almost non-existent expectations coming in here. Sort of thought that first story maybe could have benefited from more of a twist at the end, make it a little bit less obvious. Although I kind of liked how the stepfather was more kind of characterized to be more morally ambiguous than just outright evil. You know, we're so used to the evil step-parent type stories, and they didn't fully embrace that here, which was good. The third issue, aka second appearance, was, you know, probably didn't need that weird ass Adams family kidnapping thing going on. But all of a sudden we kind of get out of nowhere this mention of the Darkhold, which I know is going to become a big part of Marvel Comics lore. Doesn't appear in this story, but is mentioned, and that was sort of enough to elevate it for me. And ultimately, I was like, okay, I'm sort of glad I put this on the list after all. So yeah, we will see where this goes. We will continue to follow this character until he does make the leap into his own series, Werewolf by Night. But for the next episode or so, we're going to continue to track him in Marvel Spotlight.
Speaking of tracking, do you know who the hero who was in Marvel Spotlight number one, which is not on Marvel Unlimited?
Yeah, a character called Red Wolf, apparently.
Yep. Red Wolf.
Yeah, I guess. Isn't that
it's a beverage.
Isn't that a
it's a Western style. Western, yeah.
Western era, like Native American?
Yes.
Icon?
I believe so.
He had a pretty good Secret Wars tie-in, mini.
I was about to say that's the only way I know him was from the Secret Wars tie-in in 2015.
Did not make a huge splash, did not take the world by storm, so I thought we could probably comfortably skip that one. Maybe that was racist of me. You know, what can I say? It is weird, though, by the way, that this Werewolf by Night, this kind of horror-centric title, would be appearing in just a regular Marvel anthology comic book. You know, that's the type of thing you would see more in their, like, their black and white magazines, which aren't super available on Marvel Unlimited. Like, that's where Man-Thing first appeared. And I just think that has to do with, again, that what we were talking about earlier with, you know, they're throwing so much stuff out there. They've got to fill pages. They've got to fill rack space. And here you go. There's go ahead.
It's especially interesting given the next book we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
They launch another horror themed title called Tomb of Dracula here in 1972, but they don't start it in an anthology title. They go right out of the gate giving Tomb of Dracula its own ongoing. It's going to last for quite a while, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And here we see Jerry Conway once again given the nod to create this new horror concept And this time paired with Gene Colan on art, who is outstanding in these pages. I thought by far the best art I saw during this episode, even better than the Neil Adams stuff in terms of fitting the tone of this book and just kind of having a distinctive presentation. I loved everything about this. This Dracula, the Dracula story itself, I mean, it's a pretty straightforward Dracula story. We meet the distant descendant of Count Dracula, that being Frank Drake, who has come into ownership of Dracula's castle. He and his lover and his friend, who he has stolen his lover from, all go to set the place up as essentially a tourist trap. And wouldn't you know it, they wind up accidentally resurrecting Dracula, and bad things ensue. His lover is bitten by Dracula and turned into a vampire, and that kind of sets up the conceit of the title, where he is going to go on a war, a personal war against Dracula, chasing him across what seems to be the world, because issue 2 finds us, I believe, in London already, and kind of sets up the conceit of this title, which is Frank Drake tracking Dracula from place to place, and sees him have to make a terrible decision in issue 2, where he actually has to drive a stake through the heart of his lover and turn her into dust and free her from the pain of being undead, essentially. So another really, really good horror title from Jerry Conway. And like I said earlier, Gene Colan here knocks this out of the park, in my opinion. Todd, you're the person on this panel I trust most when it comes to art evaluation. So talk to me a little bit about Tomb of Dracula.
This is the book Gene Colan was born to draw. People do talk about how he specializes in the dark and smoky style, and you really see it in this Tomb of Dracula book. Deserves its reputation as far as the art, very different from everything going on, but it absolutely sets the mood. The story is very good, too, and a little bit worn by the numbers. Kind of shocking that they would give such an upstart, unknown character such as Dracula his own book, but... What can you do? No, it's kind
of
like
a world of public domain.
Yeah. You and I could do a Dracula book. Then what would that be like? This is pretty decent stuff. I didn't have huge expectations for the story, but I knew I was going to enjoy the art, and I did enjoy the art. Not much else to say other than I'm glad that we finally got around to this. And unlike Kree Squirrel War, this one's reputation was met. The expectations I received from having this book's reputation and knowing of it were met, because people talk still to this day about Gene Colan's work on this book, how nobody else could have done a better job. I will say that issue 2's art was not quite up to the standard of issue 1, and I'm going to blame Vinnie Coletta with a rush ink job as he was known for, but Still, the pencils are very strong. And
damn good.
Yeah. So, yeah, highly recommended. I will look forward to reading more Tomb of Dracula, and I will look forward to Dracula interacting with the Marvel U as he does in books like X-Men and Doctor Strange in the future.
Awesome. Can't wait for that. Tim, you put it on the list here. Tell us a little about your reaction to Tomb of Dracula.
I found myself very impressed. More so than I really anticipated. I had never read probably anything from this series up until this point, other than, you know, appearances by Dracula, as Todd mentioned, in various other Marvel superhero comics. And that's sort of an interesting point to jump off of as well, because there's no indication right out of the gate that Tomb of Dracula and, as we discussed before, Werewolf by Night are taking place within the larger shared Marvel universe. I mean, there's no
connection
that they're not either, right? But it's just, they're at this point, they could go either way with it. Right. So I like that they didn't really box themselves into any corners in terms of, you know, what's this world look like. Certainly we have the given setting here, but it's pretty intimate in both series. It's not got this, you know, really expansive focus. Although, I mean, we are doing some globetrotting a little bit in Tomb of Dracula with just the basic setup of we've got Frank Drake and his colleague and his lover in America, and then they make the jaunt to Transylvania. Just that flashback filling in some of the blanks there. But there's some good character work throughout this. And while it isn't anything earth-shaking in terms of changing up the Dracula mythos here, it's just because of Jerry Conway, it is far more competent and professional than just much of the Drac that we've been exposed to in a lot of these 70s comics, for better or worse. I don't know. There's something about Conway having a knack for dialogue, for one thing, and he's also sort of caption heavy, as a lot of these 70s authors are, but I think he's descriptive without being overly purple, if that makes sense. Like, his narrative captions are evocative to me, and so effective at drawing you in rather than, like, distancing you. And that's such the opposite of what we see from, like, a Roy Thomas, you know, where it's just expository, sort of up its own ass, and just pushes you away. This invites you in, which, hey, inviting you in, is that what you want in a vampire comic? Anyway, I just found myself really enjoying this. Everything Todd said about the Gene Colan art as well, I am so happy we found a book that is just the perfect fit for him, tonally, and just talk about the atmospherics and the smokiness and all of that. It's exactly what you want in a series like this. And I really thought they kind of knocked it out of the park here with this pair of issues. Was it my favorite thing on the list? Hard to say, but certainly not far from it.
There you go. Russell, I'm assuming you're going to make it a clean sweep here in terms of praise for Tomb of Dracula.
Easily. I like this actually way more than I like the Werewolf by Night stuff. This was maybe the biggest surprise of the stuff that we – well, no, it wasn't the biggest surprise of the stuff we read, but it was still really out of left field, because I was not expecting this to hook me the way that it did, but it told a well-paced and genuinely chilling story from that first issue. It had a Tim, I don't know, you may agree with this or not, but there were some – elements here that feel like they influenced maybe the 80s movie Fright Night.
Yeah,
at least, you know, but a bit more serious in tone, because that's
sure.
This was certainly not going for the comedy of it all. It was very, very dark at times, but Jerry Conway's script felt fresh. It felt very modern, I guess, is the moniker I would attach to it, for especially for the time period. Anyway, it felt like it's kind of ahead of its time.
Yeah,
it tells not an unfamiliar story. We've seen stuff similar to this before, but it sets up such an intriguing premise and is scripted so well. And of course, as has been pointed out, the Gene Colan art. I mean, we've seen the guy up to now. We've seen him do some pretty good stuff, and we've seen him do some kind of it was okay. But then this comes along, and it's like, this Gene Colan is legendary. This is where the legend of Gene Colan really comes from. It has to be, because this is just mind-blowingly good stuff. I am so happy that this book is actually in canon, and that I know what's coming up later when this book introduces us to one of the classic Marvel characters who will be joining the regular pantheon just a few short issues. Actually, I don't think it's too long before old Blade joins us in the Marvel U. But this version of Dracula continues on in Marvel Comics today. He's actually been part of Jason Aaron's Avengers run recently.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's something for people to keep in mind, too. If you want to go back to the beginnings of this take on Dracula, here it is, and you won't be disappointed. This is actually legit good from the jump, from a modern aesthetic stance. Can't say enough good about it. Tomb of Dracula is a real standout series of the stuff that we've read for 1972 and probably overall.
Absolutely. Well, before we take a break, let's jump over back into the superhero genre with another Jerry Conway, Gene Colan collaboration, as we're going to check back in on Daredevil for what feels like, God, it's been a long time in terms of episodes since we've read some Daredevil. When last we left him, we were mired in the dreck of Mike Murdock and the Stilt Man and a bunch of ridiculous bullshit that we couldn't really justify or defend. And
how dare you disparage the good name of the Stilt Man?
There that is. And that left us, that left me wondering, you know, Tim has a yep. saying he likes to drop on us that Daredevil is never not good. And so it left me wondering when this started. And apparently the answer is sometime in between the last issues of Daredevil we read and these issues. Because as I remarked in our offline chat, when we pick up with Daredevil 86, it feels like we have missed a lot in the world of Matt Murdock. Karen Page is here. They're engaged. Foggy is the DA. And the tone of the book, most importantly, seems to have shifted entirely. Perhaps it is a bit of me being colored by my expectations for this being so low, but I wound up really, really liking these two issues of Daredevil. Issue 86 sees he and Karen trying to, you know, figure out how they're going to maintain their engagement amidst the backdrop of him having this battle with a character known as the Ox, and Karen knows about his identity as Daredevil, and she's, of course, worried about his safety. By the end of the issue, you know what, they finally realize there's just no way to make it work, and they go their separate ways. And in the very next issue, Matt Murdock is shacked up with Black Widow and living across the country. So let it never be said that Matt is too long on the rebound. So both of these issues I wound up really, really liking, again, if only because my expectations for them were so incredibly low. Tim, is this the point where Daredevil becomes good and never looks back?
I don't know if I can confidently say. I suppose I should revise my original statement that Daredevil was never not good, because certainly in that early stretch of issues, it was not good. It was readable. It was fun to read because it was so terrible, but it was far from good. So, in your defense, I'd say it feels like we missed a lot of Daredevil, because we have missed a lot of Daredevil. We sort of took a break from it after that Mike Murdock business and the cosplaying as Thor. I think that was the last issue we covered back in the 60s, and it just hasn't really found its way back into the reading list. This is a series that I think its broader Marvel Universe implications and significance has been rather limited. And during this stretch of the book, from what I gather, it is highly serialized. And I don't know, in compiling these reading lists, that's the sort of thing that makes a series a little bit difficult to sort of check mm-hmm. in on. You know what right. I mean? Because you want to cover complete stories as much as possible. You also want to cover stories that, quote-unquote, matter. And it's just been it's been tricky with this book, to say the least. So, I don't know. It seemed like we were overdue. Todd reminded me that there was some significance to this story, if not for the wider Marvel Universe, then for Daredevil in particular. Because we have, as you mentioned, the engagement between Matt Murdock and Karen Page. Well, that is suddenly off as of issue 86, and she moves out to Los Angeles, I guess, to further her acting career.
Oh, also, her acting career.
Well, we will see how that ends up, certainly. I guess this would be one of those milestones in her life that will continue to go in a somewhat unique direction. But we've also got a change of scenery for Matt and his other supporting characters. We have Foggy Nelson, who I guess was the DA in New York, which big deal for him. Now he's been kind of discredited. His reputation took a hit because of some shenanigans with the Black Widow, who is now a supporting character as well. And they're all making their way to San Francisco now. So that's going to be the new setup for this book and these characters. I thought that the breakup scene between Matt and Karen was incredibly and actually admirably mature and adult for, again, a superhero comic in 1972. Once again, written by 19-year-old Jerry Conway. So, my goodness. that was... I don't know how I sort of envisioned that scene taking place in my head, just sort of knowing it was coming, but that was certainly not it. But sort of knocked me on my ass. And again, that's going to be Karen's departure for quite some time here. We then move into issue 87 with kind of just establishing that new setup in San Francisco, and Matt and Natasha are like shacking up, but they're not hooking up, and he's being overly, he's being very flirtatious and a little bit handsy, and she's, no, this is going to keep it copacetic here, and, her chauffeur Ivan lurking in the background. We will we'll learn some more about their history in short order. Fight with Electro was kind of fun, I guess. Electro is the supervillain who is trying to overcompensate for an inferiority complex. That just feels so very 70s to me. But it works. It's well written. It's effective. So, yeah, I had fun with these issues here. Just a nice little, as you said, palate cleanser after some stuff that was in the form of Avengers bad, and in the form of Tomb of Dracula and Werewolf by Night, very, very different from Capes and Spandex superheroes. So look at this, Jerry Conway, able to write horror comics, able to write, again, Capes and Spandex, able to write crime. I mean, he's just sort of a jack of all trades here. And, what can he not do? We're going to continue to track this writer and this series as well for a little bit.
Good to hear. Russell, your thoughts here, other than your desire for the inclusion of Stiltman?
I would say Daredevil this time around had one really good issue and one decently solid A. It was okay issue. As Tim said, Jerry Conway really writes great scripts. Both issues had good scripts. And that's a real standout. And Tim, I was under the impression that given your description of these issues in our spreadsheet that Karen dumps Matt, I was expecting this to be much more one-sided than it turned out. In fact, it turned out to be the exact opposite of what I was expecting. As you said, it was a very amicable, mature splitting of this relationship as they both come to the same realization at the same time. And the parties walk away from each other with no animosity. That was refreshing. Mm-hmm. It was like, wow, this is something that was possible in comics, in fiction writing? Wow, okay. Jerry Conway creates intrigue without conflict.
Yep.
If that's not the mark of a prodigy writer, I don't know what is. The story of Matt dealing with the Ox, I actually thought that was pretty good. Like Ox's backstory clearly shows that we have missed quite a bit.
I'm not sure I followed much of that, but
I was like, we've missed some events here in old Hornhead's life. All of it apparently involving anything and everything to do with the Ox. But I liked the motivation here. It wasn't just, the mustache twirling villain evil for its own sake. Unlike the Electro stuff from 87, which was almost very much that, though Conway, to his credit, does try to work in the whole Electro kind of becoming a bit of a schizophrenic, like his speech pattern changes periodically, and they call that out for what it is. So I said, okay, well, that's at least something different. That's not your typical mustache-twirling villain, but it's still... It wasn't all that intriguing to me because Electro, I find, is really one of the lesser Spider-Man villains for me. He's somebody that I've never really latched onto all that much. Despite him having like moments here and there of greatness, he never really gets there for me. He's not a top tier. But I liked all the stuff that was going on around the villain through line, like all the character work between Matt and Natasha. I thought that was really good. And the artwork on this issue, on both of these issues actually was pretty fantastic. So, yeah, this feels like still it may, I don't know if it is or not, but as was alluded to earlier, maybe this is the turning point for Daredevil. Maybe this is where we start to say the good times. Well, not for the character himself personally, but for us as readers, maybe this is the good times of Daredevil just finding their footing. I also find it intriguing that here in 1972, in these issues in particular, you have moments where the cops are not big fans of superheroes. They seem to be getting to that place where they're starting to turn on them. So it's to me, maybe I'm reading because I know what's coming in the mid-80s, but it feels like the seeds are being planted all along for a real shift in the relationship of law enforcement and characters in spandex that will undergo its ultimate change right around Alan Moore's Watchmen. But here it's like you're starting to see a little bit of that resentment building. And I don't know, I get the feeling that this is not the last time we're going to see something like that in this series, or maybe even in other comics that we also read in this year's lineup.
Absolutely. Todd, your thoughts here on this 1972 check-in on Matt Murdock?
Well, if you're going to be dumped by Karen Page...
there are worse ways to rebound, right?
If you, and you end up living in a mansion with Natasha Romanoff in San Francisco, it's all good, honestly. You know, that's kind of... I would get over her fairly quickly, too, that engagement. But I don't know the deal with Yvonne yet here. There's some intrigue there. There's this Danny French guy who's coming along. But I want to find out, because Daredevil is a book that's taking itself a little more seriously these days. It's done a little, these days being 1972, done more in earnest, not trying to match the Spider-Man formula of the wisecracking character. We're seeing a little bit more emphasis on the law and Matt Murdock's dual life as a lawyer and a superhero. The Ox stuff was a bit convoluted. I guess I kind of followed it. It was like a superior Spider-Man thing, but the original host body died, and the scientist criminal was trapped in the scientist's body, but then his nature took over. Long story short, we got the Ox back, and the Ox was a character that was from Spider-Man. I can't remember the name of the team, the Enforcers, perhaps?
The Enforcers.
With Fancy Dan.
With Fancy Dan in Montana.
Yep. So there was the Ox. And then Electro, also from Spider-Man. So we want Daredevil to come into its own and step out of Spider-Man's shadow, but we're still using Spidey villains, too, in fact, here. Art by Colin is absolutely solid, especially with Tom Palmer, master... really good inker at this point. So yeah, this is Daredevil to me, at least at this point, for it is 1972 level good. How about that? Liked the accurate details of San Francisco, and got some good details about my city and the Coit Tower and the hills.
I just can't get beyond that Electro costume redesign. Not that his original one was any great shakes with the big lightning bolt, but now he's got a two-tone lightning bolt or two-tone helmet with four lightning bolts sticking out of his side. The kind of development of him just having an inferiority complex. Well, I mean, there are worse ways to have it, but how are we to know that he has a speech impediment, which is kind of implied? People are making fun of the way I talk, and so I became a supervillain. And now I'm in San Francisco, and I don't know why, but I am, because it fit for the story. That being said, I still enjoyed it better than your average superhero comic book, especially for the era. And I like Natasha better than Karen at this point, anyway.
That's a good point. Natasha is a very interesting character and probably a little bit better than at least the Karen Page that we came to know through the process of this podcast, who was pretty damn generic there in those early pages of Daredevil. Well, with all that being said, let's go ahead and take a break, guys. When we come back on the other side, we're going to go cosmic because we're going to talk some Adam Warlock and some Galactus and then wrap up with some discussions of Hank McCoy's solo adventures and the debut of Shanna the She-Devil. Stick with us. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to be Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wingbar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to be Nation pop listeners, this is your manager, Todd Weber, here to tell you all about the goings-on, placetobenation.com. Starting up with our Place to be Nation pop podcast feed, the Hard Traveling Fanboys review The Boys, Volume 1, by Garth Ennis and Derek Robertson in this edition of The Long Book Hunters. If you haven't checked out The Boys TV show on Amazon, you really should. It is something else. I loved it. On DC4U, our weekly look at DC Comics, Russell and myself conclude Justice League Month with the hilarious hijinks found in the network TV special from 1979, Legends of the Superheroes, The Roast. On the inaugural sports edition of Looking Forward, Looking Back, Andy Atherton is joined by the Cowboy Roger Morissette, Scott Criscolo, and Peter Winson to look forward and preview the upcoming NFL season, as well as look back and analyze the most recent seasons of the NBA and the NHL. The Year in Pop returns, with Andy and Scott being joined by George Ribellino, Dr. G, and J. Arsenio D'Amato. Look at all those good fellas to discuss the news, sports, and pop culture of 1977. On a brand new Sunday Groove, David and guest Andy Helene discuss their personal Desert Island discs. Facebook users, go to the PTBN's Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament, like the page. We are continuing the Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament. There's four pulls a day. We're in round three. Never Gonna Give You Up is going strong. Sweet Child of Mine, probably gonna take it all, in my opinion. But like the page, vote every day. It is a ton of fun. Over on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you've got the PTBN Mothership, the Place to Be podcast. JT Scott and Peter Winston take a look at the last Saturday night's main event of 1989. Ben Zani has a football-themed episode of Row 1, Seat 1 with a pair of guests who discuss the New England Patriots and the Miami Dolphins. On the episode 3 of Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT, D'Amato, and Jenny run down the entire month of ECW Hardcore TV following the night the line was crossed from 1994. And on episode number 7 of You Don't Know Billy Jack, Drew introduces Jordan to Jumbo Tsuruta versus Dengeki Tenryu from June 5th, 1989. Lots of 1989. We're also paying tribute to 1994, 25 years. We've got lots of great content and articles, podcasts, lots of stuff talking about that great year in pop culture. Every Wednesday on Place to Be Nation, we've got the most interesting and unexpectedly funny stories on the World Wide Web on Glenn's Weekly Walk. Great collection of links for Wednesday reading. Check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. Get in on the conversation today. Start researching your list. Those are due at the end of the year. We'll see what the best pay-per-view match is. I'm going with Steamboat Savage. And now back to Marvel Age.
Please to be Nation Pop. Welcome back to the Marvel Age podcast. We have had a hell of a time here during the break, getting ready, getting prepared to bring you the second half of our show. And we kick off our discussion here with Marvel Premiere. The first two issues of this title are going to see the adventures of Adam Warlock given their own standalone treatment. Adam Warlock here is going to be written by Roy Thomas and drawn by Gil Kane, and in much the same way that Roy Thomas brought an overly expository fashion to those Avengers pages we discussed earlier, he brings the same thing here to Adam Warlock, as we've got to set up not just the mysterious origins of Adam Warlock, but also a somewhat complicated story involving the High Evolutionary, and I will leave his optional nickname for our good friend Tim Capel here in a little bit, the creation of Counter-Earth, and how all of that goes awry, and how Adam Warlock winds up becoming the hero of this Counter-Earth, which of course, by the way, in case you have never read the old HTF column on Spider-Man Unlimited, is exactly like our Earth. It just sits on the opposite side of the sun. I can't even do that in a straight fucking face. Everything about this suggests that I should hate it, and yet I didn't. Like, it was it great? No, but I think the Gil Kane art saved it and made it inoffensive to me, I guess, is the best way I can put it. And what high praise that is, calling it inoffensive. Tim, tell us about your thoughts here on Adam Warlock and, of course, your beloved Evolutionary.
Must I? Yeah, I guess inoffensive is a fair enough way of putting it. This sort of feels like decompressed comics before decompressed comics were really a thing. Because it is so much exposition. It's so much Roy Thomas filling the pages and telling us things without really telling us a story, you know? Mm-hmm. And issue one of Marvel Premiere, this is not the first appearance of Adam Warlock. Well, I guess it is the first appearance of Adam Warlock, as he comes to be known. But this character known as him first appeared in the pages of Fantastic Four in a two-parter that we did not read, somewhat to my consternation. I wasn't in charge of the list back then. And then moved on to a one-and-done story in Thor, which I have read but also was not on our list, kind of good. And that sort of set him off on this track. Meanwhile, we have the High AF Evolutionary, who truly is high AF in this story with his scheme to create a counter-Earth. He's sort of cloning the Earth, right, where he just takes a rock and decides that this is just like the human or any sort of biological genome that you can replicate. We're going to do the same thing with this hunk of rock from the Earth to create what is going to be known as Counter-Earth. And along the way, we get this sort of recap of stories that the High AF Evolutionary has appeared in that we also did not read. But I will say it's a pretty effective recap, because even though we did not read these stories, we get a pretty thorough sense of his history and how he came to this point. So I didn't hate it. I probably would hate it, actually, if we had read those stories, because it is a very, very extensive recap. So his plan is successful. He does clone the Earth. He sort of puts it through this accelerated evolution and history where it comes to resemble our Earth, ultimately, in all respects, except it does not have superheroes, superpowered beings. Notably, he points out that Reed Richards is like just a scientist, and Victor Von Doom is, well, just a scientist. And I guess that's an important distinction. What does any of this have to do with the guy who will come to be known as Adam Warlock? It's almost, there's two different stories here competing and sort of kind of grappling for an advantage here. And I don't know if Roy Thomas had any sort of affinity or took a liking to this character, him, who would become Adam Warlock, and just decided to use him in this high evolutionary counter-Earth story or what, but here he is, and it has given him a newfound purpose. He is going to be the defender, protector of this counter-Earth, and meanwhile, the high AF's evolutionary, the new men that he created from animals are trying to undermine him, and that's okay, I guess. Again, I did hate it. Get the...
And I've gone cross-eyed.
The man-beast, right? That's the big bad of the new men. He's a wolf, or a dog, or I guess a wolf who's been evolved to become this, this arch-nemesis of the high AF evolutionary. Issue 2, I will say, was... It's almost what those like Comicsgate chodes think that they're talking about when they complain about comics being too woke. Because we've got this kind of diverse group of teenagers, ethnically diverse, who are sort of dumped upon and at the same time being kind of assholes about whatever their position is, which isn't made entirely clear. And the whole thing just feels very out of touch. Like it's Roy Thomas trying to do social issues comics. It's nowhere near as egregious as that Captain America issue, the All Lives Matter issue by Gary Friedrich, but it's still pretty bad. And it's trying to impart this message that just rings so hollow. And it wants to have this kind of real world relevance that it does not earn at all. But somehow still, I would agree with you, Nick. I didn't hate it. There's some okay action, and I kind of like Adam Warlock just as a character. It's just, what is this setting him up for? Like, it's such a bizarre premise, and I don't know where we're going with this, but I'm curious enough to find out and put up with some of the other bullshit.
Absolutely. Todd, let's get your thoughts here about this title, and specifically your thoughts on Gil Kane's illustration of the crucifixion in a superhero book.
Oh, I forgot about that.
You know, I guess I missed that particular panel that was in one of the... was that on Counter-Earth, or was that a high AF evolutionary saying, well, if there was no superheroes, then
so on page
Jesus
20,
wouldn't die.
The top panel of page 20 in issue 1 has the high evolutionary going through the events of the history of this Counter-Earth, and he's saying, one crime follows hard upon another, even unto the ultimate transgression. Which is something like the ultimate challenge, I believe, but that is neither Hulk Hogan nor the Ultimate Warrior on those two crosses that are being depicted there.
Well,
I'm waiting for my Marvel U to load. But I will say that I hated this. And... Oh, there it is. Yeah. I see Jesus. Yeah, there's a lot of crazy crap in this. I just didn't like this at all. I don't care about the High Evolutionary. I mean, it's laughably bad with his Animen, Newmen dudes that are beastly. It seems like a bad toy line idea that never got produced. And Warlock is almost treated like a Christ-like type figure here on Counter-Earth, you know?
Let me ask you this. I should have asked him earlier.
I'll hate it if I want to.
No. I was going to ask, is the gem that's put in his head, is that later retconned into being an Infinity Stone?
I'm going to say yeah.
But what was that? It just came out of nowhere.
I wasn't sure. I thought it might be, but I wanted to ask you guys. I figured you guys would know.
It is.
I don't understand. How did he even, like, all of a sudden he's like, now you've got this gem in your forehead. Go forth and whatever.
It is the first appearance of the Soul Gem.
So I thought it might be the Soul Gem, but I wasn't. I wanted to check before I just outright said it.
It just showed up, though.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Making it out with it in his back pocket the entire time. Sorry, I didn't mean to derail your thoughts, though. Go ahead.
Continue. No, it's okay. This is a terrible comic, series of comics with characters I don't care about or like, art that's not the best I've ever seen, Gil Kane. But they're trying something differently, I will suppose. I would more likely read a Quasar book than this, I think. This is notable because they took the character him, pronouns pal, and turned him into Warlock, and which is a more kind of a confusing name because this is not a male witch. But he's golden. We're going to see a push for him, hopefully, in Guardians 3, Guardians of the Galaxy 3. We would think so, with a totally different origin than this, I would think. The cocoon oogs me out every time. I hate that thing. This is not a pleasurable reading experience. And then you have your four...
The cocoon is what happens to him when you feed him after midnight, I believe.
Yeah. He's got the... Why does he have a lightning bolt on his chest? There's no canonical... Because
Roy Thomas wanted a connection to Golden Age Captain Marvel, I guess?
I don't know. I just dislike everything about this. It makes me uncomfortable.
I anticipated dislike. Making one uncomfortable was not something that I anticipated. Russell, are you uncomfortable with how much you dislike
It's like my son. He is ashamed to tell people that he likes Power Rangers, right? Like, it gets him emotional. That? I'm ashamed to show, hey, you like comic books, right? What about this one?
Not so much.
I'm melting.
Russell.
Todd has gone bald.
I don't know how you follow that. But I'll try because... I am not uncomfortable with how much I disliked this exposition-heavy like slog, because that's what it was. It was one-third of each of these two issues is spent in full exposition mode, expositionary dialogue from the jump, because we have to catch you up on a whole lot of history in order for you to understand any of what's going on. And then all we really get is Counter-Earth out of it. So I guess you're welcome. Thanks, Roy Thomas. That's exactly what we wanted. He is no longer the high AF evolutionary, though, Tim. He is now the high AF expositionary.
Oh,
because
very good. I like
it. Because that is his role. That is what he does. Yeah. That is the only part he plays in this whole series. And look at them trying to make it edgy, just as it's putting you to sleep by giving you the crucifixion in a little, you know, I guess like gritty-esque.
Perhaps the only
scene
page in comics history that gives you both the crucifixion and Adolf Hitler on the same page.
Thank you.
It's right there, and it's like, wow, this. we thought this, like, this issue was going pretty rough up to this point, and then it just, like, shoves itself right off the cliff and hits every fucking loose rock on the way down, because it is just dumb. It's boring. It's boring bad. I don't give a shit about any one of the characters they introduce in the second part. I certainly don't give a shit about Adam Warlock. Nothing he does, like, makes me care about what's going on with him. I was kind of rooting for the High Expositionary's original creations to win out here and just kill him off. But that didn't happen, so I guess we're stuck with more of this. If somebody can explain to me the appeal of Adam Warlock, I would be very willing to listen. But it probably still won't work. So, you know, knock yourself out.
But one day he'll give us Infinity Gauntlet. I guess that's the only real.
It can't turn out any worse than the Kree-Skrull War. It can't. It's not possible. Or is it? God, I hope not.
I'm reasonably sure it will not.
It couldn't be. That's a Jim Starlin joint. There's no way it's bad.
We shouldn't write off this character until we see Jim Starlin.
I was about to say, Jim Starlin.
Jim Starlin's going to come along and probably make this character good. But you know who's not going to make this character good? Roy Thomas. So that's enough, I think, out of the High AF Expositionary. I'm done with him. I'm done with this version of Adam Warlock. Let's put him back on the list when he doesn't suck.
Let's put him back in his weird cocoon.
Mm-hmm.
That oogs you out.
That oogs you out. Oh, God. Well, all that being said, let's move on. And it would not be an episode of Marvel Age if we didn't check in on the first family of Marvel. So let's look in on the Fantastic Four in issues 120 through 123. A story written by Stan Lee, still drawn by John Buscema, and it sees us pick up with the FF as they are threatened by a being known as the Airwalker, who has come to Earth and who is just wrecking shop. But wait, it's not the Airwalker. It's the Angel Gabriel. But wait, it's not the Angel Gabriel. It's a Fembot. But wait, it's not a Fembot. It's a Herald of Galactus who was only doing all this to draw the Silver Surfer out so he could force him to become his slave again, but that doesn't wind up working because Reed Richards tries to steal Galactus's car. I don't know, man. It's a weird story, and yet one that I didn't wind up hating. And I think where I finally came around on it was we read four issues of this Fantastic Four, and while it was inoffensive, it wasn't, you know, like anything great, it was inoffensive, and it breezed by. And I got to thinking to myself, God, compare these four issues of Fantastic Four to those three issues of Avengers that felt like they would never fucking end and assaulted my senses as I read them. So, for not being offensive to me, and for being relatively easy to read in breezy comics, and I still kind of pop every time we get these early 60s and 70s appearances of Galactus, I don't know. I kind of like this. I think Fantastic Four, overall, over this entire project, is probably the biggest surprise in terms of modern Fantastic Four. Almost all that I've read is bad, and yet, for the most part, the 60s and 70s stuff, kind of hard not to find at least something to like in it. So, I don't know, maybe I'm in the minority here. Todd, you're usually pretty high on Fantastic Four stuff from this era. What are your thoughts here?
But first, Nick, you should really check out the current Fantastic Four book written by someone named Daniel Slott.
Yeah,
I think you're going to enjoy it.
I will do that on the same day that I burn in hell.
That is your version of hell.
That is my version of hell, is reading a Dan Slott Fantastic Four book. Not just Dan Slott comics, but specifically a Dan Slott Fantastic Four book written in 2019. No fucking thanks.
Nick's personal hell is going to be this, like, nice, like, perfectly set up room, all the alcohol he could possibly want, all the, like, his favorite foods, and then, like, giant stacks of comics everywhere that he now has time to read. Only thing is, it's all Thor comics, and when he picks them up, the name on the comic is going to read Dan Slott.
Slott, there you go.
You've given a surprising amount of thought to Nick and Hell, Russell.
Yep.
They say Thor, but they're actually Thunderstrike comics by Tom DeFalco.
There you go.
Eric Masterson.
Yeah.
Eric Masterson.
God almighty. And we have gotten off on a tangent here.
And you're locked at the Georgia Tech Stadium. So.
That's fine. Anyway, go ahead, Tom.
So much blue. These issues have so much blue.
You know?
Blue chew.
That Galactus, you don't get is a special man. Code. Enter the code, the manager, to receive your first packet.
Enter the code Oogs Me Out to receive your first
packet. Adam Warlock, uncomfortable. No, you know, these were good. Stan's back, and he's got ideas. Stan Lee is writing Fantastic Four for the short term here again. He had been off for a while, but Jerry Conway is busy doing every other book that Roy Thomas isn't doing. So we get just, you know, the classic Joe Sinnott. To me, Joe Sinnott's kind of the through line for this book artistically. I mention him every time we read a Fantastic Four story. But Airwalker keeps them busy for a while until he is revealed that, like you said, he's an angel. And then it's all this elaborate plot to, I guess, get Silver Surfer back as the true hero.
Yeah, to draw out the Silver Surfer seemed to be the point of this plot, I suppose.
So, I mean, all that's fine. We get a Richard Nixon cameo that I enjoyed quite a bit, where he and Sue Storm discuss the matter of what to do about Galactus, because Richard Nixon clearly would have the best opinion on this. Yeah, this is a bit too Stan Lee for me, I think. This is Stan's kind of crossed the Rubicon here.
All right, now you've actually just popped into my head one way that Dan Slott can get me to read a Fantastic Four book in 2019.
Richard Nixon.
If we get a scene of Donald Trump talking to Sue Storm about how to stop Galactus, I would probably read that.
Listen, we don't have any nukes left because we shot them all at the Hurricanes.
At the Hurricanes.
They were good people. So anyway, the one thing I bothered me about the art by Big John Buscema, who kind of the flagship Marvel artist, I would say, you know, the definitive how to draw comics the Marvel way. Galactus is a giant being. I don't need to see him in dynamic action poses, I don't think. You know, he's threatening. He wouldn't be able to move that fast. I think Galactus works best to me when he's just this huge Kirby visual. And John Byrne did that very well also. As far as the story, it gets kind of interesting when Reed tries to steal Galactus's vehicle. We get Toga Galactus again. We have the
used to are very impressive on Galactus. Those toned thighs, good for him.
Oh, yeah.
John Byrne gave Galactus long pants, if I recall correctly, to
probably a good choice.
Yeah.
Well, I think Jack Kirby did, and we kind of walked it back.
Maybe so. Yeah, or it was coloring issue.
It was a coloring issue.
And I'm trying to recall how this wrapped up. I read this, but I don't remember exactly.
Too.
While he was hot wiring his car,
that's right.
Hot wired his car to transport him to the negative zone instead of another galaxy.
If only he had run into Rick Jones while Rick was in the negative zone in the Kree Squirrel War. It was okay, but I maybe expected a little bit more when you say Stan Lee and Galactus.
That's a good point.
But it was quick reading, honestly. It didn't feel the big earth shattering. So to speak, story that you get with Lee Kirby, just that dynamic, mythical stories almost. You get Deus Ex Agatha again.
Oh,
yeah. So it's okay. We've read better Fantastic Four, but it is good to see Stan writing The Thing, because nobody writes The Thing like Stan Lee. And that to me is almost worth the price of admission with Fantastic Four comics.
Absolutely. Tim, your thoughts here on this four-part Fantastic Four story?
Yeah, I'm with you guys in that this was fine because it is four issues, but it breezes by. So after something like, again, that Avengers stuff and the Warlocks, well, anything Roy Thomas this episode, let's face it, we're not going to belabor that point. I was like, even Stan Lee on autopilot, I can handle that. And this does very much feel like Stan on autopilot. In fact, did anyone else think this was a little bit reminiscent of that Overmind four-parter that we read just episode, where it kind of hits those same beats. It's structurally very similar. It's paced pretty similar. The stakes are kind of similar. The escalation of the stakes, particularly. And, it's like Stan knows what he's doing on this series. He can crank them out, and even Stan Lee at about, 75% of his capacity is like 6,000% better than Roy Thomas doing Kree Skrull War. And yes, this all is a little bit convoluted in the sense that we get this introduction to the Airwalker, who, no, actually, he's the Angel Gabriel. No, actually, he's a fembot. No, actually, he's a Herald of Galact. In slight fairness or defense of these plot turns, like, the characters come to the conclusion rather quickly that he's a bona fide angel.
Well, he has a horn. I mean, naturally.
He has a horn. He's called Gabriel. But he never says, like, hey, I am the angel of myth here. Like, they all just sort of make that narrative leap. And they're wrong, of course. And I kind of enjoyed the twist that he's actually, the double twist, really, that he's actually not a Herald of Galactus. He's just trying to attract the attention of who Galactus actually wants, the Silver Surfer, his former Herald. I mean, I'll be honest, I've probably gone to greater lengths than Galactus here to attract the attention of my crush. So I can forgive it on that level. I like the concept as well.
Now I can see Galactus like accidentally liking one of the Silver Surfer's photos from like 4 years ago on Facebook
Oh, yeah. Unlike God. Too late, you know, just, yeah, picture that. So we get, on that note, we get Galactus in his summer casual wear here. He's rocking the short sleeves, the short shorts, kind of digging it. What he needs is a bathing suit with like funny animal patterns on it.
There you go.
To really complete the ensemble there. Maybe not a bathing suit, but a toga, you know, mm-hmm. with some dinosaurs or some crabs or lobsters on it. I mean, he is whatever you picture, you know.
Now,
that's the, yes.
If this Galactus outfit could be classified as short shorts or a toga, would the John Byrne design then be classified as sweatpants, perhaps?
Yes, he's a galactic entity in sweatpants.
Godsinsweatpants.com.
Godsinsweatpants.com. Demigodsinsweatpants.com.
Oh, man. Gods, we are becoming an episode of HTF here, the insulation of this podcast.
Yes. In any case, we get the great turn with Reed Richards stealing Galactus' car. I don't know. That's just, it's funny and it works, and I'm kind of okay with, even though I don't remember the conclusion to this story at all. And
he hotwires the car to send it to the negative zone.
Well, I forgot the negative. I remember him hotwiring the car, but I forgot that he sent it to the negative zone, which is very funny.
Yeah, so when Galactus gets back up in there and he starts his car up without ever checking to see if the Silver Surfer is behind him, he just hits the gas pedal and it takes him straight to the
negative. Oh, no.
Figuratively drives off a cliff. So,
I just realized they make Galactus look like the dumbest motherfucker.
They really do. Russell,
talk to us about Fantastic Four.
That's not the only out of character thing that happens with Galactus. Pretty much everything in this issue feels, or all of these issues that he appears, feels very out of character for him. I mean, we were introduced to a version of Galactus that was, you know, a force of nature, a god, a very indifferent god to everything around him. And here he comes off like, as Tim was alluding to, a needy lover. Or a needy, spurned lover is how he comes off.
Norrin, I want you back.
Exactly.
One last fuck. Just one last fuck. Come on.
We were rad together.
And, and since when is Thing able
and
to just...
And the podcast has reached a new low.
Galactus was a Fimbot all along.
Well, the Airwalker, Grapefield, whatever the fuck.
But it,
this is the remarkable thing, though. I think like this discussion brings up a good point. There's so much here that we can bust yes. on and make fun of and like pick apart, and yet I enjoyed reading it. And
I know, I'm fine with it.
It doesn't take itself too seriously.
Right, exactly. I think that is it. It contrasted against something, again, I hate to keep beating the dead horse that is Kree-Skrull War, yeah. but compare it to something like that, which is taking itself so seriously, and here Stan is just being goofy Stan, and it's dumb as hell, but it works.
It's charming.
The culmination, yeah, sorry, that's one. The culmination point where I realized that this was not the Galactus I know was when Thing just runs up to him, grabs his foot, and flips him over. That is a moment that happens, and I'm just looking
Suplex
at this
City, bitch.
Yeah, I'm just watching this scene occur, and like, huh? Anybody remember the first time Galactus appeared? Can you imagine this happening? No, nope.
Galactus erects a carousel, by the way.
Yes, he does. Like this is a thing that just that goes on and on and on. This is the point when it kind of felt like Fantastic Four has become a parody of itself.
It was.
I didn't say it wasn't entertaining. I just said it became a parody of itself.
That may be true. It's kind of bordered on that at times throughout its existence, I would argue.
This was not bordering. This was full on crossing the line. This was playing fucking the jump rope with it.
That's fair.
It's a creator who doesn't really have anything, a writer who doesn't have anything really new to say on this series. But,
clearly.
But it's not being an asshole about it. Like, he could sort of take a very cynical attitude, but he's still trying to have fun, Stan Lee is, with this series. Even if he's, again, running on fumes and sort of running out of gas at the end of it. But he's still like, I know what I'm doing here. This series almost writes itself, but people still kind of dig it. So here you go.
It was
fair enough.
It was fine. And to John Buscema's credit, he actually does a pretty good Kirby impression here. I mean, as Kirby impressions go, it is not terrible. But all these, they've really been consistent with all the artists on Fantastic Four kind of draw the main cast the same way. So at least there's that.
I am interested to see when somebody finally kind of, I mean, I get that there's only so much you can do with that costume design and that kind of thing, but I am interested to see when somebody kind of breaks from the house style on Fantastic Four. At some point, that's got to happen and get out from under the shadow of Jack Kirby.
Going to be a while.
That's what I thought. I'm interested to track that.
Even George Perez, love him, still kind of follows this lead. Does anybody else notice that the logo is different?
Yeah, I noticed that right away, and I kind of like it.
I do, too. I forgot about this particular logo. It was not very long-lived.
Long-lived. Again, an insular this podcast has become, but in any event, let's move on to the pages of Amazing.
How Roy Thomas of us.
Yes, HTF, the Roy Thomas of podcasting, and we will own that. Moving on to the pages of Amazing Adventures here, Amazing Adventures 11 through 13, which give us some solo adventures for Hank McCoy, a.k.a. The Beast, as we kind of see the debut of his classic hairy look. Not quite Blue Beast yet, going with the gray look, because as we know, all colored creatures in the Marvel Universe must start gray before they find their signature hue. I'm going to probably be the outlier on this. I did not care for any of this Beast stuff. It was very, I don't know, it dragged for me. I just wasn't I'm personally invested in any of this. Perhaps it's my lack of attachment to the X-Men. I did think the art was pretty good from who drew this? I'm trying to look.
Tom Sutton, not encountered before.
I liked the art. It was really inconsistent, though. I thought he kind of varied wildly in the way that he would actually draw the Beast. I'm looking at issue 12 right now, and from panel to panel, even it kind of looks a little bit different. So while I like the art, I would say the consistency is not great. But yeah, this didn't do much for me, honestly. You got the kind of hilarious scene of Hank McCoy using spandex straps to wrap his body into place so he can wear regular clothes, even though he's a hulking beast now. Just a little ridiculous here, but I don't know. You guys probably have a lot better things to say about it. I was pretty bored by it and kind of glad to see it go by the time we ended issue 13. Tim, being the massive X fan that you are, I'm sure you're going to take me to task over this.
Well, I'm not going to take you to task, but I will be disappointed in you. Although it perhaps is my pro X-Men bias that causes me to hold this in much higher esteem than you did. Although I will say I am singling out issue 11 more so than 12 and 13 because, yeah, once again, we've got Jerry Conway writing. Tom Sutton mm-hmm. does all three issues on art, but Conway only writes issue 11 here, which I don't know. I just kind of got into it as this reintroduction to a character we have not seen in a while and who we had only really come to know in a team setting here now on this kind of solo outing. And just the way that Hank McCoy's new life, where he is hired as this research scientist for the Brand Corporation, and it plays out as this sort of daydream fantasy where he's getting all the things he ever wanted, but it's like it still isn't enough, and he doesn't quite know what to do with himself now that he's gotten it, and he's almost self-sabotaging is the takeaway that I got from the characterization here. So it just creates the sense of this guy who is a genuinely good person, but he flew too close to the sun. And I don't know. I found the way that it was written, particularly by Conway, to be almost heartbreaking. Like it was, it kind of got to me in a way that I did not anticipate at all coming into this. This was a story I was familiar with, but I'd never actually read. And I thought it was very effective in execution. Now you do have some tropey stuff here. You know, Hank downing this serum that he's developed, this experimental mutagenic formula or whatever. And it's like, why does he do that? Well, A, it's a 1972 superhero comic, and that's just kind of a thing you do. But again, Conway sells it really well by painting it as just this expression of Hank's insecurities. And, you know, he has this newfound confidence, and it's like he thinks he doesn't deserve it, maybe. And he's undermining all of his own progress. And, you know, for what the plot required, the character work sort of got me there. So, you know, I enjoyed that aspect of it a lot. I thought issue 11 was, I'm going to say it, kind of a hidden gem. So, Nick, this is the farthest apart we've been on issues covered thus far here.
I will say at the very least that 11 was much better than 12 and 13.
Yeah, in my opinion. 12 and 13 are kind of, I mean, we're sticking with, first of all, we've got Steve Englehart now replacing Conway. And Englehart doesn't change the tone up too much here in taking on the writing chores. It's, you know, still pretty consistent, but his script is a lot bouncier and not really as introspective as what we saw from Conway. And we're kind of following that through line of the Brand Corporation and this kind of weird spy ring that I'm not super into, but it's fine, I'll go with it. And, you know, we've got sort of this diversion in the form of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, who are now just a trio of Mastermind, Eunice the Untouchable, and the Blob. What a collection of characters, you know, trying to manipulate the Beast. And it's enough to propel these two issues, I thought. I'm glad it gets wrapped up quickly enough. And some of the inconsistency in the art, I can kind of forgive for, and I don't think the story was really going for this. This is just me no-prizing, but it's Mastermind, you know, trying to manipulate not only Beast's perceptions, but ours as well as readers. So I'm going to roll with that.
Brilliant reading of that. Well, I like that. Todd, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm good.
Okay. Todd, I will now offer up my opinion for you to take it and rake it over the coals as well.
Hey, we don't always like the same things. It's free country. We all respect each other's opinions. We all get along.
I don't like where you're going with this.
No one respects anybody's opinions in this country. Don't you? Haven't you been alive?
I listened to shows and never mind. I was gonna So
do it.
Do it.
No, this is not the great debate. We actually try to change each other's minds about things. We don't just say what we like best and let it go. Oh, that's great. You like that? Cool. Let's have a beer.
For the record, I like the top half of an English muffin on the occasions in which I eat English muffins, which is never.
All right.
That's meta. That's in. But I got it because, you know, that was lightning round question. Speaking of lightning rounds, we should do one for this show someday, but we haven't. This was a decent comic. I was not expecting it to have the tone it did. It almost had the tone, at least that first issue did, of a horror comic.
Yes.
And so I had read it right after I read The Werewolf by Night. By God.
Oh, okay.
So, manipulating the Beast, you say, Tim. That's a euphemism for something.
Okay. Well,
yes. The events of Amazing Adventures number 12, I suppose. That's what it's at.
Sure. That's all that is. Well,
the sequence where he turns into the Beast, and then that same night, he goes to the X Mansion.
No, he doesn't.
No? Okay. Well, it was a flashback.
Yes. And story goes to the X-Men.
But he's able to figure out a convincing human disguise for himself.
Well.
All in the same night, yeah?
Yeah, it was a busy
because
night.
He has to show back up at work.
Like that.
And
he's got a spandex try to contort his body into a humanoid shape.
But it's comics. And everything makes sense. Nothing matters.
It was dumb, but again, I said comic book rules, whatever, fine.
I will say I liked the twist of his girlfriend being the big bad, the secret agent for Brand, who I don't necessarily know what's her ultimate goal yet. I guess we have to stay tuned. But I think I was expecting something a little bit more straightforward as a comic, and this was a little bit moodier, a little bit darker. The narration had it had kind of like an accusatory tone towards the boy, which is interesting. So the guilt of it. So different than I expected.
It's the angry Claremontian narrator before Chris Claremont.
Some people wouldn't like this because it's not jokey, funny cartoon X-Men 92 Beast. But eventually gets there. He wasn't even that character in the 70s X-Men, I'm sorry, the 60s X-Men. He's like he has a change of his personality here, where he used to be a little bit more lighthearted, flirtatious, and verbose, and they're saying it's almost like his mind is devolving a little bit here. Yes?
Mm-hmm. He's having this kind of internal battle. That's his biology is changing, is his psychology changing as well.
He's hallucinating that he killed Iron Man.
Right. because of Mastermind.
Right. Oh, that, okay. Boy, yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, it sort of creates a almost a reasonable doubt where it's like, okay, is this just Beast thinking through his now deluded perceptions that he has done this because he's in such a fragile state? Or is it all just on Mastermind? And it turns out, yes, this is Mastermind using his illusion casting powers, but Beast falls into this weird fugue state for a couple of issues where he like doesn't know who he is, and you know, that's not something Mastermind can do. So it's kind of not all one or the other.
It's just, it had a weirder tone than I expected, and I don't know if I would keep watching it or keep reading it.
Well, we're going to.
Yeah. I guess
we have no choice.
It's actually, there's not a whole lot of this left. There's like two or three issues, I think, and then we're done with Beast in this series. Spoiler alert.
All right.
Russell, your thoughts here.
I really liked Amazing Adventures number 11. I thought it was a pretty great issue overall. I liked pretty much all the stuff with this version of Beast. I thought that Jerry Conway really had a good voice for the character. Just smart storytelling all the way up and down. Loved the twist with the assistant / girlfriend being the other spy. I thought the art was nice and dark. It was creative. It kind of fit in with some of the horror vibes as Todd was talking about it. It had a little mix of that. It was that first issue anyway. Had a good mix of Jerry Conway's horror stuff that he did on Tomb of Dracula and Werewolf by Night, and then the Steranko Nick Fury. It was like a melding of these two things at first. Now, of course, 12 and 13, when Steve Englehart takes over writing, it takes on a bit of a different tone. The art is less consistent. But still, I thought those issues were solid. I read the Mastermind stuff very much the way Tim did. I thought that was interesting. A fun enough hook to keep me coming back at least for... I would say this is good for 5-6 issues. You know, tell the story as a limited thing. Don't make this an ongoing issue or like an ongoing title. I like seeing this side of Hank McCoy, how he becomes the fur-covered beast that we're all more familiar with. This is really good stuff. This is something that I absolutely loved from the first issue, or issue 11, I guess, since it's not the first issue of Amazing Adventures. But, this was a good hook for me. So I very much enjoyed this. It was nice to get some update on the X-Men, even if it's, you know, not quite the X-Men. This is as close as we get to it for a little bit. So nice to have them back in the fold, if only in an ancillary way, I guess. But
I like that little farewell that he had with his...
Yeah,
They weren't students anymore. They were young adults, but still living in the mansion. Apparently, we're going with the idea that the X-Men have basically gone into hiding since their last issue because anti-mutant sentiment is so high. So that's kind of a depressing backdrop and made even more melancholy by, you know, this departure by this original team member. And I like that it spent just that one extra beat on the team where they're just sort of like, well, what do we do now? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that the team interaction was written really well and kind of made me want to see what Jerry Conway might do with the X-Men at his full disposal. That could have been a good thing. Maybe it was a good thing. I don't know. Did he ever write X-Men proper? I don't think so.
God, I'm trying to think X-Men appearances that we've got coming up before the relaunch. I don't know that Jerry Conway handled a lot of that, but if it's on the list, if they're out there, they'll end up on the list. How about that?
That's fair enough. Good stuff for me. I And I'm looking forward to reading some of this.
There you are. Well, let's close this episode with, you know, it's been something of an eccentric episode, so let's close on something of an eccentricity, and that, of course, will be Shanna the She-Devil number one. And this comic is a perfect example of reminding us that, you know, Marvel was never political up until the last few years, really, in their history. They would never, in the 1970s, release a comic that largely centered around a message of female empowerment and the importance of natural conservation. So, yeah, no political message whatsoever here in this Shanna the She-Devil book. I liked it. It didn't blow me away or anything, but I know that Russell in particular has a lot more thoughts on it here. Interesting, because I believe, Todd, is this correct? This is Steve Gerber doing some work for Marvel, early Steve Gerber, right?
Yes, and if we had been able to read the Man-Thing one, we would have gotten some Steve Gerber there too, I think.
He didn't write it.
Oh, okay.
Well, you're not entirely wrong. He didn't write that first appearance, but this issue was published way late in the year. I just threw it on the list early because we've got a few other books like this, right, just to space it out. But he is at the same time writing a series called Adventure into Fear,
starting the giant-sized man thing.
We will be covering that, I think, in our next episode.
And good to hear. Shanna issue was co-written by a different person, or another person who I'd never
heard. Carol Suling?
Carol Selling, I think is how it's pronounced.
Gotcha.
She is... I hate to frame it this way. She is the wife of Phil Selling, who is a early pioneer of like comics conventions and I think later be a distributor. The only reason I present her in the form of what her relationship is to her husband is Marvel was intentionally trying to find female writers for a handful of series that they launched here, Shanna the She-Devil being one of them. Problem was, the boys' club that the Marvel bullpen was at the time, they didn't know any female writers. So Roy Thomas's wife is going to do one of them. We will get to that when we get to that.
Russell, I know you were pretty high on this, so why don't you lead us off here?
I was shocked at how good this was. Did not see that coming at all. The as you guys called out, both writers, I don't know who was really scripting and who was doing the story, but whoever did it, they did a pretty tremendous job. This felt not quite like modern comics, but it was certainly ahead of a lot of the things that were going on in the early 70s. And amazingly progressive issue. Something that I certainly didn't think from the very unfortunate title that this book has. But it actually is. As you read it, this is a very women's lib, a very feminist approach to the storytelling. And you can get the feeling that it really does have a legitimate female perspective on things, which is something that I think it's safe to say these books have sorely lacked up to this point. I found myself really empathizing with the lead character. I really like especially like the conservation message of this one. It gets into animal rights, the horrors of poaching, and just an all around great introduction to a new character. I don't know how long this book goes, but this first issue was really well done. I mean, it does get into some heavy background, but I thought that it was paced pretty well too, in that we get a full-on backstory origin for this character, but it's presented in a way that doesn't make me feel like, okay, we have to spend a third of the book explaining every little aspect of her life before we get to some actual good action, before we actually get to things that move this story forward. It has some of the comic book tropey stuff in it too. But as a brand new adventure title goes, this is a really solid start. This was something that I certainly did not expect to enjoy the way I did, but came away thinking I could certainly go for more of this.
Absolutely. Todd, what about your thoughts here?
Surprisingly contemporary in its feel.
Sorry for yelling there. Good arts. Great cover by Jim Steranko. Hey, there's a name we haven't heard in a while. So
there we go.
Maybe he was doing a favor for Phil selling. Or just, you know, a friend. Or because we don't see his art here at Marvel too much anymore these days. But I also liked, or I also noted, that like some of these other origin story issues, you get the character and then a flashback to the origin and then back to that main thread. You know, it's not a linear progression. It's starting in the middle-ish and then going back and you find out more about that character. Now, I'm curious how this Shanna ends up in the Savage Land someday, because in any of those stories, she's never seemed that interesting to me, honestly. This version of her, I could see working, or at least it's a nice, interesting book in a time where there weren't this many type of characters around. DC had a character named Rima the Jungle Girl. That's quite the name, isn't it? Rima. She was on Super Friends. She was in DC's titles, but she didn't make a huge splash. You have the just kind of like the Jungle Girl iconography, and that was a popular thing from fiction. So let's have that kind of a character, but let's put a twist on her by making her be a Gloria Steinem era women's liber / animal protector. You know, she's what's her title? She was not a veterinarian, but something like that at the start. And I didn't know any of those details about the character. So interesting stuff, good art, good story. Kind of another example of the new Marvel trying to branch out and diversify their character base.
Absolutely. Tim, close us out here with your thoughts on Shanna the She-Devil.
Yeah, surprisingly well-constructed comic here by Carol Selling, a person who has no professional writing experience prior to this to speak of. My understanding is Steve Gerber was kind of brought in to punch it up a bit in terms of just the script, but didn't have a huge plot contribution. So all in all, what we got was better than I think any of us probably expected going in. I like how quickly we define Shauna's key attributes here. She's extremely compassionate, she's driven, and she's capable. Those are our main takeaways coming out of this. Like, that's, you can tell if this story had any mission statement, it's to get that across. And there is some interest here in kind of expressing how those qualities intersect with femininity, but at the same time, the story speaks for itself. It doesn't get preachy, which I think is kind of the easy criticism or what you're almost on alert for, you know, reading something like this potentially. If anything, it has more of a political stance on gun violence than it does, you know, women's lib, so to speak. And that's interesting because we're looking at this framing through the protagonist's interactions with how she has been affected by gun violence throughout her life. And it sort of moves us to her side as the story progresses. It, you know, hits the ground running with that action, which I think is a good choice, and then we get the backstory, which that conceit, I think the story is well served by that particular conceit. And we also have these truly contemptible villains, these poachers, right? Which is just kind of a good shorthand for we hate these guys immediately. And it just makes our lead character all the more sympathetic. So really interesting and effective choices here. And in a debut for this character, Shauna, who on, you know, that very surface level you look at and go, okay, jungle girl, jungle action kind of comic, you don't think of that as being geared towards a female readership, right? That seems like a very male-oriented genre, as most superhero, as the superhero genre itself is. This is not a superhero comic, notably. I don't know why they thought this would be more appealing to female audiences than just doing a female superhero. Again, on first glance, you wouldn't think so, but it kind of pulls it off. I mean, not being a woman, never been a woman myself, it's certainly better written than a lot of the portrayals of women in the comics we have covered thus far. My goodness, thinking back to not even that long ago, right? There's always some kind of cringe element, even still to this day being 1972. Thank you, Todd Weber. Fantastic Four comics with a visible still girl. Yeah, this is definitely many, many steps above that sort of thing. So, you know, there will be a few more outings with this particular strategy. And so far we are, I guess, 1-for-3.
Interesting. All right, well, that brings an end to our discussion of part one of 1972. Before we head out and let everybody pull our stuff, just to give you a heads up on what we'll be covering on our next episode, the list master, Tim Capel, has done us the service. He has heard our complaints of the 21-issue reading list, and he has done us a kindness by cutting that list all the way down to only 20 issues. So a whopping cut from 21 to 20. Thank you, Tim, for that. We will be covering next time out Avengers 100, Fantastic Four 124 to 125, Marvel Spotlight 4, Werewolf by Night 1, Daredevil 88 to 89, Luke Cage, Hero for Hire number 1, Adventure into Fear 10 to 11, Amazing Adventures 14 to 15, Incredible Hulk 150, Marvel Team Up 3 to 4, Amazing Spider-Man 110 to 112, Marvel Feature number 3, and Night Nurse number 1. So another eclectic and loaded episode next time you join us here on the Marvel Age podcast. So with all that being said, before we head out, we're going to give everybody an opportunity to plug their shit as they always do. I, of course, am one half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys who can be heard here on the Place to Be Nation pop feed. We just put out an episode on the first volume of Garth Ennis's The Boys. I know that's setting the world on fire, the live-action adaptation over on Amazon Video. So taking a look at the source material and seeing how it holds up. And very soon in the near future, we will have a very special giant size edition for you guys, something of a new format for giant size, something we've never really done before, and perhaps it will be of interest, perhaps it won't. We don't actually care. Tim, plug your shit.
Okay, so you can hear me also on Place to Be Nation Wrestling. That's right, our sister feed, the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, where I co-host Talking WCW with Jennifer Smith and with Nick, your longtime hetero life mate, Greg Phillips. Our most recent episode covered 3 matches from the WCW career of Rey Mysterio Jr. So do check that out on Place to Be Nation Pup. Once again, myself and Jennifer Smith have our show Talking Pup. Don't know what our next episode is going to entail, but it's true of any episode of Talking Pop. We will have one coming to you shortly. And you can find me on Twitter, complain about what I've said on this episode, about the reading list, about life in general, I guess, if you're so inclined. I am at Cyke68, C-Y-K-E-6-8 on Twitter. And that's about it.
Absolutely. Todd, plug your shit.
Do I have to? So my name's Todd Weber. I don't have to. So I don't have any shows other than DC For You, which Russell will tell you about better than I will. Because I'm tired and I got stuff to do. No, I'm just kidding. DC For You. It's the only weekly DC show here on Place to Be Nation Pop. We're talking Justice League in August, and we just wrapped that up. We just talked about four topics. The Justice League movie, we talked about all of the different favorite Justice League members, teams, incarnations, writers, artists. We had a special episode about Justice League America 200 from 1982 and written by Jerry Conway. How about that? And finally, we wrapped up the month with a look at Legends of the Superheroes, The Roast on DC, DC Universe app, which was pretty fun thing. And we'll stick around and you'll hear some great Flash content in September. Is that right? I can never remember.
That is correct. Yes.
You go, Russell. You take over. I'm done plugging. I have nothing else right now.
Yeah, we'll have a current events episode. Should be out around the same time as this one to wrap up the month of August. And then in September, we're moving right into Flash Month, where we're going to talk all things the Scarlet Speedster. We're going to have a couple of special guests join us on our first episode of that month. And then we got our usual look back at a classic Flash issue, and also look at Flash in other media, where we'll be taking a look at the 1990 pilot episode of The Flash that starred John Wesley Shipp that you can watch on DC Universe. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can hit me at Russell_Sellers. That's also my handle on Instagram. And definitely please listen to every episode of DC For You. Todd and I really love putting that show together. And coming up in the wintertime, Sam Neely and I are already in process of recording new episodes of 90 to Nothing, where we're looking at movies all from the year 1990. So you guys be on the lookout for that one. First episode of that should premiere sometime around December.
Outstanding. Well, with all that being said, we thank you for listening to the Marvel Age podcast. Be sure to join us next time as we continue on our year-by-year journey through the entire publishing history of the Marvel Universe. We hope you've enjoyed it. Enough said.